She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Buddy, you are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we are going to give you lots of incredible information to think about today. Thank you so much for joining us. The show is sponsored by the Fairfax Company, and I do want to note that they are the largest privately owned and completely sustainable landfill operation in Southern Arizona. Please remember them if you're listening from Pima County for your post-construction and landscaping waste, because I've been out there quite a few times, and they really do recycle about 97% about what comes into their three landfills. And we have another great show lined up. Surprise. Working with us today, being here today, is Patrick Graham, Arizona State Director of the Nature Conservancy. And I spoke to Pat briefly before the show, telling him that I have been a major believer and supporter of the Nature Conservancy for years, probably over 30 years. They are working with us to make a positive impact around the world. There are more than 30 countries, all 50 United States, and even in our own backyard. So, Pat, thank you for being with us today on this Saturday.
Appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
Okay, so I just want to do a little shout out so that everybody knew you were here, because I like to remind everybody that I'm live here every Saturday at noon at MrsGreensWorld.com. Remind you also that you can listen on your iPhone and Droid, and I love it when you do. When I get texts, I'm listening from LA, I'm listening from New York. And also remember that podcasts of all of my shows are available on my website within about a day after we do the broadcast, right there for your listening pleasure. They live forever. And please don't forget to connect with me on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest, or email me at info@MrsGreensWorld.com if you have any questions. Pat, we're going to make it all about you from here on in, and I've got pages of questions, some of which I got from your team and some of which Mrs. Green wants to know. So let's start with, what is the mission of the Nature Conservancy, in case some of our listeners do not know that?
Great. Yeah, the mission of the Nature Conservancy is pretty straightforward and pretty ambitious. It's to conserve the land and water upon which all life depends. And we are a global organization working on five continents and, as you said, throughout the United States.
So what I think is important also, it's a vast mission, and that's like the Reader's Digest version for sure. But I think if you don't want to, I would be happy to share a little bit about your background, because I think it speaks to the leadership that you are able to provide because of your, the content and scope of the experience that you've had. So do you want me to brag about you, or can you brag about yourself a little bit?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, but I think it's really important, because you don't just, come from Arizona, and you have a lot of experience that brings that all of that wealth of experience and information to Arizona. So you did serve 5 months in a fellowship in Africa in 2009, working with Namibia to help create one of the world's largest conservation areas. And I would certainly hope we have time to talk about that in the show. You're a member of the Conservancy's North American Leadership Council, which to me helps with the integration of all good ideas, their Freshwater Council, and their Board Leadership Effectiveness Group. So I think those are important to mention. And then you also came from the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks in Montana. And when you were there, and I know I'm reading this because I didn't memorize it, but it's all good stuff, so I want people to know, you were the Deputy Director, Fisheries Division Chief, and had numerous other positions. And you were the Montana State's representative to the Northwest Power Planning Council on Fish and Wildlife, and trustee for the Natural Resource Damage Claims for Montana. And you did a bunch of other things, but at some point I'll interject it because I don't want to embarrass you. And if you're like me, just stop already. I did a lot of really good stuff, and you did. So there's a lot of credibility to the things that you're doing here in Arizona right now. So let's talk about we have the vision, the global vision of the Nature Conservancy. And I want to start out with a quote from Andrew, I think you say his name, Deutz, the Director of International Government Relations. And as most of us in my world know, the Rio Plus 20 summit just completed. And he said an important, really an important conversation that should be ongoing. He stated that, and I'd like to segue into what one of the talking points for you. The quote is, "One of the challenges of this conference has been the missed opportunity of many of the world's leaders to make the connection between the G20, which was a financial short-term debt conference, and Rio Plus 20 this week. The G20 was focused on how to solve the world's short-term financial debt. The Rio conference was focused on how to solve the long-term ecological debt crisis." And I don't think I've ever heard that exact phrase before, and it was like, bingo, that's what we have. We've got a big debt we have to repay to the planet. We have not fully exploited the opportunity to solve the first problem by addressing the second. And of course, from Mrs. Green's world, the ecological debt should be the driver behind every decision. So would you talk a little bit about the connection between a healthy economy and a healthy environment?
Yeah, no, that's a great connection there. You know, it's really at the core of this. If we're going to address these problems, it's got to be, people have to understand the connection and the relevance to their own lives. And I think that's one of the things, as we become more urbanized and a little bit more distant from nature, it's easier to lose those connections and the benefits that nature provides. You know, everything from our air to our water. If we had to generate water as they do in, say, Israel, at a desalinization plant, so our water bills would quadruple in many places. So nature provides us a lot of things very cost effectively: our food, our fiber. Basically, our entire economy is sustained by nature. And so oftentimes, unfortunately, in the last few decades, it's been portrayed as you can have a healthy economy or you can have a healthy environment. And that could be, nothing could be farther from the truth. The two are totally linked together.
They are inextricably bound. And to me, it's like any rational thinking human being will see that if we start depleting nature's natural resources forever, there's no going back. And it's as obvious as the nose on your face. But some of the global leaders, I was rather disappointed in the lack of representation. And I don't know, I read a lot of comments on the Rio Plus 12 summit, Plus 20 summit, and it just seemed to be, I expected so much more for this 20th year because we need to do so much more. I don't know, were you excited, happy, or looking, being on the bright side, or saying we could have done so much more?
Well, it's interesting because we have been very active in some of the, you know, the international negotiations over the past few years, particularly on issues related to climate change and others. And, you know, every time we come away feeling like hopeful, but short of any real progress being made. And each time you come away from that, and we finally said, you know, there's got to be a different way. And there was a study that was done by a group of researchers around the world that said, you know, just on the issue of climate change, you could address about a third of it from things that we know how to do now. It doesn't require new technologies. It's just things that could be done without any kind of treaties or any kind of major commitments. And so that was really helped kind of reframe the way we began to think about it. So we went out and we started talking with a variety of corporations and others to say, what can we do now to turn this around? Not just on climate change, but on water and food security and a variety of different issues. And so that's what, you know, we helped organize a part of the conference down in Rio that just addressed that. And one of the outcomes of that was a report that was released where 22 large companies committed to very specific measures that they would do as part of their corporate responsibility to address sustainability issues. And I think that's really what it takes. It's going to be, if we wait for the decision of political leaders to lead us out of this, I think we're kidding ourselves.
I think I could not agree with you more. Even when it comes to something, the business piece is so magnificently huge because of the impact that major corporations can have. Just for example, Starbucks, they can have global impact with implementing one new policy. But down at the consumer level, you can make a big difference by never using a plastic bag again and have an impact on the environment. So there's, to me, there's something for everyone to do, and we need to all be pulling in the same direction. Let's talk about in Arizona, and I know some of the things you want to talk about are near and dear to my heart. You have had extensive experience in Montana, and you have been a part of Nature Conservancy's global community. What are some of the areas that you're focusing on here, and are they unique, or do you find them in other parts of the globe?
Well, that's an interesting question, because what I found, having worked in Africa and in Latin America in particular, and in Mongolia, that the issues are more similar than they're dissimilar.
Right, I agree.
You'd think not, but they really are. I mean, it really does come down to issues related to water. It comes down to how we grow. It comes down to sustainable production of food and fiber. And those are the things that really oftentimes come back to these sort of the core issues. And a lot of the solutions they affect different peoples in different ways, but there are as many similarities as there are differences, and I think that's what I'm seeing. And so I think Arizona has the opportunity to lead in three areas. One is around water. We live in a very arid area, and so our ability to figure out how to live sustainably in this environment is important, because a good number of people in the world live in equally arid lands. I think the area around land health, particularly forests, I think offers a real opportunity. If we can make the forest restoration, the forest health issue work in Arizona, my goodness, you can make it work anywhere. And growth. We have the opportunity, really. There's still as much growth as we had, and it doesn't seem like it today, but if you look back over the previous decade, a tremendous amount of growth. And the opportunity and the predictions are that we'll double again within the next 25 to 30 years. There's a lot of the painting that has yet to be, or a lot of the canvas that's yet to be painted. And I think we have the opportunity to do it much smarter than we've done it in the past, and in a way that's certainly much more sustainable and can really improve the quality of life here instead of degrade it. So those are three areas that we're working on that I think Arizona can make a contribution, not only locally, but globally.
Well, let's go to the water issue, because I've had everybody from Robert Glennon to Jonathan Overpeck and many, many others on, and it seems to me that a common thread and their challenge is that as long as water is almost free in the United States, and Tucson is a perfect example, we don't really pay for water. We pay for the infrastructure for, the city of Tucson to bring us the water and the monitoring and all of that. Do you think we can get people's attention without having it cost a lot of money? Do you think that's a barrier for the call to action?
Well, I think it's a good question, because I think, clearly we respond at least temporarily to price spikes. You've seen it with gasoline.
Right, gas goes up. Drive less, yeah. Or get a fuel-efficient car.
But there is an adjustment over time. And so, 6 or 7 years ago, when the gasoline prices spiked to $3 or $4, whatever it was, people freaked out. And then now it goes up to $4, and, it's an inconvenience. And for some people, it's certainly a real impact. But people have adjusted. And so I think price is one aspect of it. the way we're looking at it, and it really ties to some of the work we're doing in Latin America, which is to make the connection between where people's water comes from and, you know, where it gets used. And that is that the cheapest water we'll ever have is the water that nature provides us. When you have to start putting it into a canal and shipping it long distances or putting it through a desalinization plant, you are dramatically increasing not only the cost for delivering the water, but the energy costs that go along with that. You know, power plants are built to move water. 20% of California's energy use, 20% is used simply to move water from point A to point B.
And Pat, what's ours? I mean, we really spend a lot of energy to get our water also.
Yeah, it's pretty significant, and I think that's one of the debates over the coal plant up in the northwest, here in the Four Corners region.
Huge debate.
Yeah, and I think that, so the one area, and this is not a silver bullet, but it is certainly an important thing that's overlooked. In the past, the idea has been if we need water, that we go and find it somewhere and bring it here. And we've tended to overlook the water that we have already. And that links back to the health of our forests. A lot of our water emanates in our mountains and our forests. It links back to how the water is used and conveyed down our rivers. Investments made in the watershed and in conserving our rivers is our belief, and we've got certainly data showing this in many other areas, is the most cost-effective thing that you can do to secure water for your future. So it's going to be a combination of learning how to maintain the quality of your life using less water. So conservation is a key part of water security in the future. And then the second part is ensuring that our natural water supplies are optimized by really taking seriously the investment in maintaining the health of our watersheds.
Well, and I think it's an interesting choice of words that you use, water security, because when I first read Robert Glennon's book about 3 or 4 years ago about surviving the world's water crisis, he said there, and many others have said, the wars of the future will be fought over water rights, and it's already happening. So it is a matter of world security, our security, the United States security, and our water supplies, because it's something we absolutely cannot live without. So I think it's a new thought of connecting the word water with security, because certainly when I grew up, it was not something that you connected. There's just water. That's
right.
All we think about. So I think it's interesting to talk about the health of the forests. I mean, we're going to have to go to a break in 2 minutes, so I'll just kind of set the tone a little bit here. You know, you live, I believe, in Phoenix, right?
Yes.
I live in Tucson, and to me, what it looks like outside all over, we were to Mount Graham about a month and a half ago, just absolutely a box of matches. And I hate saying that because we are so desperately needing rain. We have cactus dying. I mean, cactus don't die in Arizona. So I think it'd be important, and I want to say this without making, you know, we lost our cabin in the Wallow Fire in Greer, so we know a lot about the issue, and we're hoping that there's no repeat because there's still a lot of forest up there and it's dry as can be. So when we come back, can we talk about one of the things I admire most about the Nature Conservancy, and that is your collaborative efforts, both globally and locally. So we can talk a little bit about the Four Forest Restoration Initiative, the White Mountain Stewardship Program. I love that. There are many, many things still going on. The White Mountain Stewardship Program saved homes during the Wallow Fire. So does that sound like a good way to go?
Excellent. Look forward to that.
For the next thing. Okay. And let's do a couple of calls to action throughout the show, because you are supported in large part by donors, and every little bit helps. So what's the best way for people to get to your website?
Nature.org/Arizona. So nature.org/Arizona gets you right to connecting with the Arizona chapter, and you can see some of the things we're doing. And there's an opportunity to donate there, and you're exactly right. That is, even though we're a global organization, the resources that support us here are all raised in Arizona.
And we have to bring that up each time because we want to keep Arizona safe. We'll be right back. We're having a wonderful interview with Pat Graham, who's the Arizona State Director of the Nature Conservancy, working to make a positive impact. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. I'd like to share with you a super low payment opportunity on a brand new 2012 VW Jetta S from Chapman Tucson. With $1,999 down and a 39-month lease, your payment will be $129. Go check this great new sedan out at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan in Tucson. And you better hurry, offer ends June 30th. Be sure to tell them Mrs. Green sent you.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill. But I have a bigger reason to give. A while back, I lost my job and I couldn't even support my family. A lot of people don't know Goodwill can help you find a job. But that's what they did for me. I've had this job for 7 years and I love going to work. You know how they say Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill needs your donations now more than ever. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And certainly, if you've been with us since we started, we are giving you a lot to think about. I am very happy to be interviewing Pat Graham, who's the Arizona State Director of the Nature Conservancy. And their mission is to work with us to make a positive impact around the world in more than 30 countries, all 50 United States, and yes, even in our own backyards. And they certainly do that. And there's evidence of their good work everywhere. To go to a Nature Conservancy preserve, which is one of the things that started, Pat, that's what you guys started doing. And I remember that. Why my husband and I got excited is that there was a piece of land that was going to be developed. And the Nature Conservancy came in and bought the piece of land, and we still visit it today. It's like it was right up close and personal. So thanks for taking time on your Saturday to talk with us about the important work your organization's doing.
My pleasure.
Okay, so some of the strategies that you're doing to get the land right here in Arizona in better shape. I don't want to sound like Debbie Downer about I'm about hope, possibility, and change. So let's not refer to Arizona as a matchbox ready to explode. Maybe the rain will come tomorrow.
But, you know, I'm sorry to hear about your loss of your cabin. And, it really does. It's a poignant reminder of just how urgent this problem is.
And how fragile, the forest is.
It really is. And on one hand, it's very fragile. It is a tinderbox. The possibility of losing you know, hundreds of thousand acres at a time is almost, it's just something you don't even want to think about. On the other hand, nature is resilient. So it's both fragile and resilient. And so what we have an opportunity to do here, and really the compelling need, is to apply the knowledge that we've learned through things like the White Mountain Stewardship Project, which is the nation's first and largest experiment in trying to create a long-term contract to allow for the reinvestment of private business. So the key element of this thing really is getting the stability out there that private industry can come back in, but with the guidance that no longer are they focused on just taking out a few big trees and leaving the rest, but in fact just the opposite. They need to make the money off the small trees and do it in a way that not only leaves the forest safer, but that it provides better wildlife habitat and helps provide the beginnings of the moisture for our rivers.
You know, we had a bobcat on our porch, and we do not live in the unpopulated area of Tucson, and it was so skinny and so scrawny, and I want to put water out, because where is a bobcat going to get water to drink? There's no water for anybody to drink. It's like, oh my gosh, that poor thing. And I made jokes on my Facebook page with some dear friends and said, is it okay if I invited in to the air conditioning? But it's like, the wildlife is hurting as well. Who makes up the White Mountain Stewardship Project? Who's working together in that?
Well, it's actually that's what's interesting about it. It's a unique collection because it involves local people. You know, the U.S. Forest Service is involved in it, but the idea there is to make it a community effort. So you have a variety of different interests within the community that are involved: private citizens, the Nature Conservancy, the Forest Service, the Game and Fish Department, and others are working together to help, because one of the things that I think that's kind of spurred the problem here is partly it's economic, but the other is there's just been a lot of lack of trust and, you know, litigation and other things over how the forests have managed. And so it's not just fixing the economics, but it's doing it in a way that restores the trust amongst the different parties so that we can create a more, like as you say, more hopeful effort. One of the things that we have been focusing on the last 6 months or so is a recognition that, you know, now with the Four Forests Initiative announcing the big contract, which will be the most ambitious forest thinning project when it all comes to fruition in the nation, but no one's been really focusing on what's it going to take once you let the contract to make sure that this really gets done. And it's our view that we really need to rethink this thing, the whole opportunity. We're still thinking about it the way we might have 20 years ago with the technologies and the approaches, but this it's a much more complex thing. The woodworkers that are being sent out there now, in the old days, people would go out there and mark the different trees. Well, you know, one of the forests was spending $1 million a year just in paint to mark trees.
Are kidding me.
Is that something?
that is really disgusting and awful.
Yeah, so not only is it not going to be effective in this new thing, there's no money for it. So how do we do this in a way that is cheaper, faster, but also better?
And more sustainable. I don't want to be pithy, but it is to create sustainable changes, which is not marking the tree with a blue piece, you know, a blue slab of paint or splash of paint.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. That is a really disgusting number. But I'm past it. So let's just move on and talk about today.
Well, but think about the opportunities here. What do we have? I mean, we didn't have things like the tablets, like the iPad.
Totally.
Or GPSs and all those things. So there's an opportunity now to redesign the way that this whole thing works so that the information about how much wood is being collected, where it's being collected, can be actually sent right to the operator sitting there in the machine that's going through the forest and interacting directly with...
In real time.
real-time
information. I just didn't think of that. That is extremely exciting. Take the iPad and be taking pictures with it and putting it. Oh, my gosh, that's very exciting. Okay.
Yeah, so we've got a grant, and we're providing some support. Our science team is going to be working with the U.S. Forest Service to actually, we came up with this idea to take, this is all off-the-shelf technology. You know, it doesn't require inventing anything new. It's just how do we take what we already know and apply it to doing this? It'll allow us to have better monitoring. It'll allow us better communication. And really, the cool thing about what these people will be doing going out there, you know, in the old days, and I've known a lot of loggers from my days in Montana. I mean, they are hardworking as anybody you'll ever meet. But you know, a lot of it was there's a lot of skill in knocking down those big trees. But in essence, a lot of it was all laid out for them. These folks are going to be going in there at a pretty rapid clip, and they are literally the artists redesigning the forest of the future. They've got to make these decisions on the fly as they're going through there, what to cut, what to leave. And when they're done, you know, whether we have a forest that's going to support all the bears and the deers and the bobcats, or one that's more like a tree farm, really, it's up to them.
We'll wait and see. And I'm hoping on the A, not B.
And that's part of what we're talking about here. So we're working with the contractors, with the Forest Service, and others to help ensure that option A is exactly the one that we come out with.
You know, it just really occurred to me. Needless to say, we were very involved in the not just the mourning, but the processing of what happened with the wildfire. And not that many cabins burned. I'm grateful for that. I think we should say to people that are listening, don't avoid Greer, don't avoid the White Mountains. There's still water running. It's still beautiful. Greer is still lush, and it's about 25 or 30 degrees colder than Tucson. But I think what really just struck me, lots of people that knew way more than I did were really, really angry at the Forest Service. And when you tell me that they spent $1 million marking trees, I get that. But they really, people that had worked for the Forest Service that are really committed to the beauty of the White Mountains, they were really angry that this one got away as much as it did. I was too busy crying personally, but that's, so the water issue is a perfect segue for this, because one of the things that I know, but I would like you to share with us, the management of the water, which then relates to the healthiness of the trees and the ground covering, is so critical. So what can you do about that? What role does the Nature Conservancy play in helping with that huge issue?
Being in the connection between the forest and the water?
Yes, and you've written about that many, many places about if you don't have healthy trees, the bark beetle comes in, and then the trees are dead, and then the lightning strikes because the trees were, you know, affected by drought. So how does the management of the water integrate with that?
Okay. So in a couple, three ways. One is when you have a thick forest where you do have snow, it stays up in the branches, and a lot of it evaporates. It never makes it into the groundwater, so you lose that.
Interesting, right.
Second, when you've got all those roots fighting for what water does get in the ground, that water never makes it into your rivers either. And it makes the trees less healthy. There's only so much water, and they're fighting for it amongst each other. So a thin forest, a forest that's more natural, will increase the amount of water that actually gets into the ground and ultimately forms the water that comes down our Salt and Verde and San Pedro rivers. So it's really critical relationship between our health of our forests and getting those thin and increasing our water supplies. So they're completely linked together.
And I am going to sound, when I first read the notes when I was prepping for the show, it's like we're going to talk about Arizona's rivers, and I thought, well, that'll be a brief subject, but it's like there really are rivers to talk about. I'm from New Jersey, so it was a little bit of an adjustment when I first came here, and they're saying, that's the Pantano Wash, and I'm like, well, what does it wash? There's nothing. I've seen water in it maybe like, you know, 30 times during the monsoon. So it's a very different mindset. Now, I'm kind of jumping around a little bit about here, but I want to go back to something you mentioned about the White Mountain Stewardship Project. Will it really help create jobs? Will the implementation and the money from the Forest Service, because they depend on how much it snows up there for skiing and how many people come up in the summer to get away from the heat. It's a very recreational economy, and if things are bad, they hurt, and if it doesn't snow, they're devastated. So what is the economic impact for basically what I would think would be more sustainable jobs, not as dependent on the snow and the tourists?
Well, that's right, and the White Mountain Stewardship Project has created about 300 jobs, and while...
That's huge for up there.
It's enormous, because, you know, you think about Tucson and Phoenix and the recession of the last 3 or 4 years, but prior to that, things were booming along pretty well. Well, the rural Arizona has been in a recession for a couple of decades, and so to be able to create 600 or 300 good-paying jobs up there is tremendous. And the new For Forest initiative has the potential to create even more jobs. So, yeah, it's extremely important piece of the equation. The other part is, you referenced this earlier, is that we know it works now, because places like Alpine and Greer, and it's unfortunate there was some loss of property, but compared to what happened in Rodeo Chetiskay, it was far, far less than what we saw then. And that's because most of these communities had thinning done around it through, as a result of this White Mountain Stewardship. There's a great example in the small town of Alpine. The forest came, and you can see the pictures of it. We've talked to people that were there. That forest fire came ripping over the mountain, came down towards town. Flames were 60 feet above the top of the tree.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's hard to even get your head around.
It's hard
it
to
really
know how
is.
Fast that was going, but there was about a mile of forest that had been thinned as a buffer to that town. The fire burnt a third of a mile into that thinned area before it dropped to the ground. When it dropped to the ground, the firefighters were able to suppress it, and it never made it to town.
And, you know, my husband was a firefighter in the Forest Service a long time ago, and he came home from a fire once when he had first started, and he said, "You don't have any idea about the force of a fire until you're anywhere near it." I mean, and that sounds a little bit obvious, but he said it creates its own weather conditions.
Yep.
And you just get out of the way, and you don't know where it's going to be, where it's going, and if there's wind. I mean, it was just, we just sat here and waited and stayed glued to every webcam there was on the helicopters trying to go in and trying to see our cabin. But it was fast and furious. And the other fire is a good example, much more scarring, it seems to me, than the Wallow fire.
Yeah.
It was, you drive up through White River, and it's like, wow, it still looks like a ghost land in many of the places there. So what do you do with the connection of the Nature Conservancy, and how much of a role will you have in making sure what you said that's so important? How will you help to assure that these practices and that the new ways of doing things and the new technologies are utilized to move us forward more quickly, because we really still have to hurry?
Yeah. Well, urgency is really at the top of the list here. And so there's three things that we bring. One is, you know, our experience, our science.
Globally,
and our people,
right,
that know how to do this stuff. We manage our own land, so we have people that actually know this stuff. And we have great scientists, so we bring that piece to it. Second, we are focused on trying to bring people together. So, I mean, we're just one player. I mean, so we're talking with community college, we're talking with operators, we're talking with the Forest Service. So one of the other roles that the Conservancy is good at and likes to play is what we call collaboration, but it's really about bringing the right people together to focus their combined efforts. And then the third part is that we'll be investing some of the funds that we get from our loyal supporters to put our mouth where our, or put our, you know, our money where our mouth is. And so it's one thing to ask other people to invest in moving this forward, but we've already lined up a couple of grants and some other things. So we're not just coming to this with an idea, but it always helps when you bring some resources to say, hey, look, you know,
This is where your dollars are going. They're in your own backyard. We have to take another fast break. We have a lot more to cover. We're talking to Pat Graham, Arizona State Director of the Nature Conservancy. Please stay here with us.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Mrs. Green here. Have you seen the new 2012 VW Beetle? Well, I have, and it's adorable. The good news is that between now and June 30th, you can check one out at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street. They're offering a special lease option with $1,999 down and a payment of only $179 a month with a 39-month lease. For the best ownership experience possible and a great new car, be sure to check them out and tell them Mrs. Green sent you.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With 5 ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if we haven't given you a lot to think about today, I would invite you to think about that, because there's certainly a lot of content that Patrick Graham, the Arizona State Director of the Nature Conservancy, has shared with us about global issues they're working on, about issues in the United States, and about issues affecting us every day in our own backyards. And am I not a living proof of that? So let's go on to Pat. I want to ask you, there's three things I'd like to cover before the end of the show, and I told you it would fly. I'd really like to talk about the public-private partnerships. More specifically, you are a nonprofit, but it seems to me that you have the attention of business leaders globally, which you mentioned from the Rio Plus 20 summit, and also in Arizona. Do you have strong business leaders, partners here who are getting it and really realize that without water, they're not going to have much of a company?
Hey, that's a great question. We have the Southern Arizona Leadership, which is the Business Leadership Council in the Tucson area, the Greater Phoenix Leadership, and the Flagstaff 40. This past year have been working on putting together a vision, kind of a strategic plan for Arizona. And one of the areas that they wanted to cover, they kind of had an umbrella called infrastructure, and they invited me to participate in that part of it. And it looked at three things. One, which was growth. How do we grow in a way that's sustainable? Another area dealt with water, and how do we meet our water needs in the future? And the third dealt with sort of more of the quality of life issues related to things like our state park system and other areas. So, Yes, I think they are paying attention to it, and more now than probably in the past. And so, I mean, some of them always did, but I think it's a broader recognition of how important it is for them. So I think that's one indicator.
So that's really important to know, because we have to get business attention. And it's just so, it's to me, it, again, it's a very obvious issue. Are there specific areas that you're focusing on in terms of strategies to restore Arizona's rivers? Because, I mean, I have seen recently the San Pedro and the Verde River. I haven't been up to, we're going up to Greer this weekend. But what are you doing for some of the rivers right here in our own backyard to help preserve them for the future?
Yeah, there's so let's just, we can talk about a couple. One, you touched on the San Pedro, which is, you know, a critical river in that it, you know, there's only two rivers that flow north-south between Mexico and the U.S., and one of those is the San Pedro, and, you know, that a river flowing through a desert going north-south.
Yeah, you could imagine when this Jersey girl saw that. It was like, what? Well, okay,
yeah.
This is, am I going to live here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to use your imagination.
Yeah.
I mean, they, a lot of the water, it turns out, in these desert rivers is flowing underground. So a lot of the vegetation that's supported, you could, you know, I mean, rivers, it kind of sounds funny, but it, you know, rivers survive in an arid area. A lot of that water has to move underground. And
Right. So
it isn't just what you see on the surface, but what's there. So the groundwater management becomes critical. What happens along the banks of the rivers is important as what's happening in the river. So a couple of things, you know, we do that wet-dry mapping. This is our 14th year.
And explain what that is, wet-dry mapping, because not everybody knows what that is.
Yeah, so what we started, Holly Richter of our staff working down there started this program that gets people involved in looking at what the river is, and it grew from just looking at it around Sierra Vista to the entire river beginning at its headwaters in Mexico, and now all of its tributaries. Over 200 miles of streams are inventoried over a couple-day period where people go out, citizens go out, in crews and with GPSs and map what areas are flowing and what areas are not. And we always go during a low flow period, so we're looking at kind of the worst case situation.
Which right now would be almost any time.
Yeah.
I know I'm sounding cynical. I'm not, I'm going to change that. I'm not a cynical person, but it's like, okay, during those high rushing, gushing water times.
Well, we're in a drought period and we've been in an extended one for over decade, you know, almost 13 years now.
I know.
So it's a tough time, but we are, so we pick the time right before the monsoon so that we're not, so we can get a kind of look at it, sort of a worst case look, to, and then compare it from year to year to see if the things that we are doing are making a difference. And there are some stretches of river up by Sierra Vista where land acquisition to retire some of the water uses along the river. And now one of the areas is looking at trying to do some recharge. Basically what that is capturing water, say, that's run, would have otherwise run off streets and other things.
Right.
Putting it into a system and then pushing it back down into the ground. We call that recharging the groundwater. And what that does is it raises the water table, then that water flows into the river and sustains it. It also creates a buffer for between the community, which is drawing the water down, and the river. So in some ways we're coming up with having to come up with some creative ways to allow the communities to continue to exist, but do it in a way that preserves the river.
And stormwater management is so important. I remember one of my very first shows back when I was on Clear Channel was Brad Lancaster. And when he told me how much water just gets washed away in the monsoons, it boggles the mind. It's like the $1 million the Forest Service sent on trees. Not that I'm going to forget that anytime soon. But it's like to be able to harness that power of nature and use it for the man's best interest is magnificent.
Well, and you know, the statistic that really shocked me was that the amount of water that actually makes it down into the groundwater is 2%.
Oh, that's just
2% out of all the water that falls. So think if we could double that, just go from 2% to 4%. you've doubled the amount of water that's recharged into the ground. So, I mean, small changes can really make a difference. So we're really focused on how to increase the amount of water that gets back into our groundwater. The other thing we're working up on the Verde is working really closely with the irrigators, particularly in the middle Verde between Cottonwood and Camp Verde, on a variety of things to try to improve efficiency in how the water is taken out. We found one instance where the water that's used is diverted several miles upstream from where it's used, and yet where it's used is not very far from the river, yet the river gets dried up for that several miles. So a simple fix there
could be
putting in a pump with a solar panel and pumping the water from the river directly to where the use is, and then shutting off that section of the canal. You could rewater several miles of the river with just that one single action. So those are things that you mentioned earlier, because basically the water itself is free. There isn't a lot of incentive to invest in those kinds of things. So that's where we can come in and help identify some of these things. The water user just wants to make sure they're able to continue their practices, but if we can identify ways to bring resources and ideas that will allow them to do that in a way that's less detrimental to the river, they're all for that.
And while what's running through my head as you're talking about this is, I don't want to sound like a poster child for the Nature Conservancy, but I am one. All of the things that you're doing they cost money. You're providing not just staff time and man hours, but incredible enriched expertise. That's what I would call it, because you do have the integration of everything that the Nature Conservancy globally is working on to bring to the solutions to challenges that we face. And you personally are involved in a lot of those councils. So to me, it's like, let's not reinvent the wheel. Did anybody have this problem in Namibia? You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's all the more reason why any listener that might be moved to look at donating, it's really important, and it is in our backyard, and the healthy forests and the healthy rivers impact our quality of life every single day, and don't I know that? So I just want to do that. I know it sounds like a commercial, and I hope it does, because it comes from my heart when you're talking about it. All of these different projects you're involved in take not just time, but money, and you are a nonprofit. So let's remember that in our giving times. One of the things you wrote on the call to action is getting people, I love it, of course, not to think that the problem is too big or too far away, but why every little action they take can add up. And I write it every day. I call it little steps, big impact, small steps, big impact. Just do one thing. So what are some of the other ideas that you have? You talked about one that I think is worth really mentioning, about a defensible space around your home. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, everybody that lives in an area that's potentially threatened by fire can help both the firefighters and themselves by venting and taking out making sure the trees aren't too close to the building, or the trees are thin enough that if the fire does get close, that it's going to stay on the ground and not the treetops, and clearing the brush around up to the trees. And I know that sometimes changes the aesthetics of the place, but obviously losing a cabin
really changes the aesthetics of the place.
That really kind of puts it in perspective. So, you know, and I think that's the challenge here. The landowner themselves can only do so much if they're close to public land, but the combination of the things are really essential. At the home level, you know, there's lots of things that we can do, and people say, you know, what difference does it make if I, if I turn off the water while I'm brushing my teeth?
But you
think about 4 million people in Phoenix and 1 million people in the Tucson area, and you add all those, that up, and it does. It's a huge amount when you think of all the things we can do. So one of the things we're doing in our Wild About Water program is connecting with the Project WET there at the University of Arizona. And one of the things is a water audit program for their schools. And a small school down in St. David on the San Pedro River and one up in the Scottsdale area. So a lot of these kids, they go in and they actually measure the water use in their school, and they look for ways to cut back. And something as simple as a $1 water flow restrictor, which basically the way they work, you really don't notice you're getting less water because the way they aerate it, it still looks like a lot of water. But you can cut your water use in more than half by simply putting in these $1 or $2 flow restrictors right into your faucet. And so they calculated that for their school, came up with, you know, tens of thousands of gallons of water. Then they figured out how much of that water was costing the school, and they went to the school board and made presentations in both cases, St. David and in Scottsdale, and said, hey, look, you know, here's how much it would cost, here's how much you're going to save. And the school board in both schools allocated the money to put the flow restrictors in. So this is something that was done as part of a school project, but ended up, you know, actually having a tangible effect on the sustainability of the budget for the school itself. So, you know,
I am so familiar with St. David. It was a place that my mom and dad loved to go. They loved to go to the monastery down there.
So yeah. We
would take the kids and bring a picnic lunch, and there were peacocks and pigs and goats and sheep. I don't know what all there were, but we would go literally down to St. David and spend the day. It's just a wonderful little community down there. But when you talk about it, tens of thousands, I did not miss that. You know, for me, I'm writing a book, and one of the chapters is called Guilt-Free Flushing. When I realized the number of gallons of water we waste flushing the toilet that you could drink, you could literally drink out of your tank. And I don't know, are you familiar with, do you know Daniel Stolte? He's a science reporter at the U of A.
I don't.
He's amazing, and he does a lot of, I mean, he's really internationally known for his science reporting, and he follows me on Facebook. And Pat, he sent me this DIY, do-it-yourself, little contraption that he put in for $1.50 in his toilet, and it was basically a big brass ring that he attached to the flapper so that you could control the amount of water that you use to flush the toilet. And I'm thinking, here's Daniel Stolte on my Facebook page writing about what you can do to minimize your water use. Well, before we go, I would like to thank you again. I'd like to tell my listeners to, we still have about 3 minutes, but I always rush this part, to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and visit my website. And not just because, it's because we have people like Pat Graham sharing global, national, and local information from the Nature Conservancy on things that impact our life every day. And I love having guests like you on. I love my guests. I mean, I've had such high caliber of guests. I learn, and then hopefully the people that are, you know, a part of Mrs. Green's world learn also. And let's do your website again. It's nature.org/Arizona.
Forward slash,
and people can spend some time on that website. It's what I call content rich. It is a very, very vibrant website where you want to do a lot of click through. And believe me, Pat, I visit a lot of websites in my role as Mrs. Green. It's like, oh, what's this? My attention deficit like really kicked in high gear. And I hope that our paths cross at another time. I love the work you're doing. And if we have like 1 minute left, I think. Can you talk about in 1 minute what one of your favorite projects was, and then maybe we can have you back again and you can talk more about it that you've ever worked on?
Yeah, well, I think that the two favorite projects are the one in Africa, where we were working to try to establish a natural area by helping make the native people, they share in the value of the wildlife. The elephants and the lions is a fascinating story. And the other is in Latin America, where we are helping create water funds that help improve the practices up in the Andes Mountains that are now providing cleaner water down to cities like Quito and Bogota and a variety of others. Both
Boy,
of those
talk
really
about different there. Yeah, I've been to Quito, and yeah, you don't flush the toilet lightly there. okay? Yeah. Really and truly. So thank you so much for being on, Patrick Graham, Arizona State Director for the Nature Conservancy. Next week, we are going to have another awesome guest. Her name is Kelly King, and she's the Vice President of Pacific Biodiesel from Maui. So visit us at Mrs. Green's World. Make it a great green week, and think about contributing to the Nature Conservancy. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for all you do.